Kill them.
Kill them both. We're missing Antiques Roadshow.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 62. My name's Terry Frost. And this time around, we're looking at a couple of movies that are very much more style than substance, which is not a bad thing. I'm going to go back to some substance next time around, but this time around, I thought I'd do some stylish films that aren't necessarily deep, but are still a lot of fun and well worth people enjoying. How has everybody been? I've been pretty good here. I'm still doing the radio gig for ABC Darwin. We did skip a week because there was a cricket match on in India, which gazumped the broadcast, and so we missed out a week there. But yesterday I spoke for about 10 or 12 minutes on ABC Darwin about The Time Machine, starring our good friend from the last podcast, Rod Taylor, and I had a good time with that. I'm still enjoying doing that. Every Friday night I get a phone call. Ivor says, hi, how are you? You're going to be on in 50 seconds. And then we just chat about movies for somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes on the air. And I do enjoy it. I'm getting less tense about it now, which is nice. I've done four of them so far. But it's a little less tense, which is a good thing. If I was getting more and more tense, I'd probably explode around the 15th or 16th time I did it. But it really is a lot of fun. And in a way, it's this podcast in a shorter form by another medium. And if anybody out there who's a podcaster gets a chance to do even a marginal thing on radio, I recommend it. I'm not sure how much it's going to expand my podcasting empire and how much name recognition I'll get based on this. But I do enjoy it. It's every week I've got to think of one movie that's really cool and groovy, have a chat about it with a like-minded soul, and go from there. I'll let you know what the next two are. Now, it's hard for anybody else to get them. They do stream on the internet, but they stream live, and they're not archived anywhere. So if you can work out what time where you are, 9:45 p.m. Australian Eastern Summer Time is, and if you go to the ABC Australia website for Darwin, you'll be able to stream it live. Now, next two movies we're doing. Next time we're doing Lady from Shanghai. Orson Welles, Rita Hayworth, Everett Sloan. Fantastic film. Going to enjoy doing that. The time after that, we're doing The Bad Seed from 1956, I think. So, yep, Evil Children. Always a nice subject for radio. But I just bumped the microphone and nearly took my ear off. Sorry about that. But let's get back to what we're doing now. What have I been watching lately? I just finished watching a Disney film. Now, I'm not big on Disney films as a rule, as we all know. To be honest with you, the last really great Disney film ever made was The Three Caballeros in about 1946. So that's where I stand on Disney films. But I did see The Sorcerer's Apprentice starring Nicolas Cage and some dweeby geezer playing the juvenile lead. And Alfred Molina was in it, which is always a cool thing. Monica Bellucci looking stunning, as Monica Bellucci invariably does. And Alice Krieg. It's a kind of a special effects fest. And a bit Disney in a sense. So there's no character arc there, but Nick Cage gets to do some wacky stuff. And, you know, it was a time passing kind of movie. If you've got kids, I'd recommend it. If you don't have kids, maybe wait till it's on cable or something like that. But I saw that. Now let me go back through what I've watched. I did say I was going to keep a list, didn't I? But I haven't done that. Give me a moment. I saw a very recent French steampunky movie called Les Aventures Extraordinaires d'Adélie Blanc-Sec, which is about a girl called Adélie Blanc-Sec who gets involved in adventures with a pterodactyl egg and mummies who come back to life and things like that in 1911 Paris. And it was a hoot. It was really funny. The special effects were pretty good too. It had its tongue very much in its cheek, very steampunky. It's based on a graphic novel series, a French graphic novel series, and I recommend it. It's got a lot of fun stuff in it. I actually got some of the pop culture references now. Being that the gutter snipe that I am, if I get pop cultural references in a foreign language film, I'm really surprised. Even though I do know a fair bit about French pop culture for the 20th century, there was a reference to Zizi Jeanmaire 1960s cabaret act, just as a little tongue-in-cheek addition in the film, and I kicked myself when I saw it. And if I had been there with anybody else, I watched it on video, but if I had been there with anybody else, they would not have got the joke. I love being in on obscure jokes, and this one was fairly obscure. The other thing I did notice is an Egyptian mummy comes back to life and walks past the Louvre. And this is the Louvre before the recent additions to it. And says, that would be a great place to put a pyramid. And of course, nowadays, there is a great big glass pyramid in that part of the Louvre, which wasn't there in 1911. So there's those kind of little wry jokes in there. And it is a bit of fun. The French do some types of fantastic films very well. They really do have a knack for it. And they've got Paris there as the perfect place to set an adventure film in any time in the last 200 years. You can just go to Paris, digitally remove the street signs, and you've got the perfect place to do a period film. It's just one of those lovely things that they haven't ruined their city by recent additions. So if you get a chance to see that one, I definitely recommend it. I've also been watching Morecambe and Wise Christmas specials. Now, you might not know who Morecambe and Wise is, but they were an English comedy duo that started around the time of World War II and went right into the 1970s together doing very funny English comedy things. And the lovely thing about the comedy Christmas specials that they did for about 5 years, from about 1969 till about 75, is they got serious actors to act the fool in their Christmas specials. So the couple that I've watched, they had Peter Cushing in it, playing the straight man to a comedy duo. They had Eric Porter, who you might remember from the Hammer film Hands of the Ripper, in there. You've got Edward Woodward when he was young and playing the tough guy in Callan, yucking it up there. They got everybody in there. They had some fantastic actors. They had Glenda Jackson doing a song and dance number. It's just a lot of fun, so I've been enjoying dipping into those. I won't go too much more into what I've been watching, but Not a hell of a lot, because Sal's hogging the TV at the moment. She's discovered Boston Legal, and she's now watching her way through about 77 seasons of that, saying the name of William Shatner's character on that TV show about 77 times an hour. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and then I'll get back into the first movie, Bullet.
Just kiss and then brotherly wear. smile that made a dream begin. Clouds your vision. It's just the shadow of a dream that you're living in. She never did. Beware, my brother, beware. For the female of the species is deadlier than the male. Memories of kisses on a summer's day. That's all she loved you when she went away. Now you pay. By walking streets you've never known. When the night comes, sitting in places that you know.
That was the Walker Brothers featuring the inevitable and inimitable Scott Walker singing Deadlier Than the Male from the 1965, I think, spy movie of the same name. So, on to Bullet. I'm actually going to let Dr. Zom start me off with Bullet. I'll play the voicemail I just received from him when he found out I was going to be doing Bullet. And then I'll get into my spin on that particular film. I'll start off by giving a little bit of a background before I do that, because it's only right that I actually presage what he's going to say. And I've got tons and tons of paperwork about Bullet here. I've just got to get some of it. Okay, Bullet's a 1968 American thriller starring Steve McQueen, Jacqueline Bisset, and Robert Vaughn. It was directed by Peter Yates and distributed by Warner Brothers. The film won an Academy Award for Best Film Editing. Frank P. Keller, the film editor, won that, was nominated for Best Sound. And basically the film's remembered for the car chase through the streets of San Francisco. It was regarded as one of the most influential car chases in history. But anyway, here's Dr. Zom on Steve McQueen and Bullet, and a few other things in the inevitable. Why am I saying inevitable all the time? Dr. Zom style.
Paleo Cinema, this is Dr. Zom. Just noticed that you're sneaking in an episode today, this afternoon, which, since you're on the other side of the planet, could mean yesterday, could mean tomorrow. I'll have to check the space-time continuum to find out what the hell is going on. But I just wanted to call in. One of the movies that I saw that you were reviewing was the movie Bullet with ultra-cool god of coolness, Steve McQueen. And I have a lot of memories of Steve McQueen, especially from the movie Bullet, the car chase, the super cool clothes, the hair, the shoulder holster. Yeah, Steve McQueen. Also, Robert Duvall shows up in this movie, pops in there and does a little taxi cab driving for the King of Cool. But, of course, we all know about the car chase and them showing up on the set and finding McQueen behind the wheel of the car, driving it, and telling him, hey, get the fuck out of the car. Bud Eakins, who was one of his good buddies, motorcycle buddies, who I have read a lot about, drove the car and did a lot of that kind of stuff, and jumped the motorcycle in The Great Escape. But, yeah, Steve McQueen, he's a cool guy. almost makes me wish that I hadn't read his wife's book, because Steve seemed like he was a pretty cool guy, just like, you know, we all hoped he would be, until he hit the drug stage, and then he became a pretty big bastard. But anyway, you know, she got back at him for all his infidelities, all his abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, when he was huffing the white powder up his nose like it was going out of style, by having a liaison with an actor that had won an Academy Award. And she surmised that one of the things that bothered McQueen more than the fact that she actually had a liaison with someone else was that the guy had an Academy Award. And he was very jealous. He was very jealous of anybody who he thought was a better actor than him, or that other people thought was a better actor than him. And later on I found out, it didn't mention in the book who it was, but I don't think, it's a long time ago I read it. Later on I found out that the actor was Maximilian Schell. How do you like that, Steve McQueen? So anyway, that's about all I have to say about Mr. McQueen. You know, loved him in just about everything he was in. And wish he would have been able to be around a lot longer. The guy was a motorcycle enthusiast, much like Dr. Zom. And also, he was a Renaissance man who, you know, did a lot of things. Took a lot of chances on the screen and made some movies, went out, you know, that some people wouldn't necessarily find to be commercial, but he took the chances. And anyway, babbling on, Dr. Zom must go and have a spot of raspberry tea and watch political programs so his blood pressure will go up through the roof. This is Dr. Zom from America saying Zom.
Thank you very much for that, Zom. It's probably the first time in a podcast anyone has ever done an impression of Maximilian Schell. And I hope it's not the last, too. I think it's something that podcasting definitely was lacking. Thank you for all the info about Steve McQueen. I've been watching my brand new Blu-ray of Bullet, which I picked up for $9 at a local department store, which is a groovy thing. I hear from Vince Rotolo, I was listening to his podcast, he said that movies like Bullet were originally put out on HD rather than Blu-ray back in the days of the HD Blu-ray wars. And they weren't available on Blu-ray, so maybe that's one of the reasons why they're so inexpensive to get now on Blu-ray. But whatever the reason, there's some great documentary footage on the Blu-ray as well. There's a doco about Steve McQueen. There's interviews with Bud Eakin and other people about the making of films with Steve McQueen. So it's a very rich Blu-ray for that extra material there. And you could do worse than using that as a reference point for the career of Steve McQueen. Anyway, on to talking about the movie. Now, while I talk about the movie, I'm actually going to play the audio from the car chase in the movie underneath what I say about the movie, just to give it a little bit of atmosphere. I don't know if this is going to work, but yeah, you try new things and see how they go. Okay, just to give you Top Gear fans a heads up on the cars in the car chase scene in Bullet. Bullet's driving a dark Highland green 1968 Ford Mustang GT390 CID fastback. He's chasing two hitmen in a dual black 1968 Dodge Charger RT4000 Magnum. Now, that's the car chase part, but that's not all the film's about. There's actually some other worthwhile parts to this film. The car chase is only about maybe a tenth of the film. So basically, I'm going to give you the plot synopsis and then talk about why I like it. Ambitious politician Walter Chalmers, played by Robert Vaughn, is holding a Senate subcommittee hearing in San Francisco on organized crime in America. To improve his political standing, Chalmers hopes to bring down mobster Pete Ross, played by Vic Tabak, with the aid of a key witness, Johnny Ross, Pete's brother. Bullet takes place on the weekend before the hearing from Friday night during the opening credits to Sunday night. Following the theft of $2 million and his escape to San Francisco, Johnny is placed in the San Francisco Police Department's protective custody for the weekend. Chalmers requests Lieutenant Frank Bullet, Steve McQueen's unit, to guard him. Bullet, Sergeant Delgetty, played by Don Gordon, and Detective Carl Stanton, played by Carl Reindel, give Ross around-the-clock protection in the Hotel Daniels, a cheap flophouse near the Embarcadero Freeway. Late Saturday night, a pair of hitmen burst into the room and shoot both Inspector Stanton and Ross, seriously wounding both of them. Bullet wants to investigate who shot the pair and find the mafia boss who ordered the hit. Chalmers attempts to shift blame onto Bullet and the San Francisco Police Department. So that's basically the setup there. It's a police procedural, and it's very cool. It's got Steve McQueen right at the peak of his career. McQueen was probably one of the biggest stars on the planet at the time. He spent the early 1960s doing films like The Great Escape, which was his breakout role. He then went in to do The Magnificent Seven, of course. He'd done Nevada Smith. He'd done a number of other films as well. This is just before he did Thomas Crown Affair, which I talked about in a previous podcast. So McQueen is the go-to guy for action films at this stage of things. And in this one, he is pretty good. He's very understated, not over-the-top bombastic. It doesn't actually require that kind of thing. It requires cool. And that's something that Steve McQueen had in bucket loads. He was really Mr. Cool of the time. He was just, you know, the most charismatic, interesting and iconoclastic actor of his time in a lot of ways. He just didn't give a shit about what people thought. Though underlying it all, he was a very insecure guy. He came from incredible poverty. He did spend some time in there's a car chase starting in the Boys Town orphanage. And basically came from absolutely nowhere and nothing. And he, throughout his life, like a lot of people who have that kind of a background, he thought it would all go away. He thought all his success, all his money, all of the things that he had earned through his talent and hard work could be taken away from him at any time. So in that sense, he was a very insecure man as well. Didn't demonstrate that necessarily, but that was a part of his character, along with the fact that he had an interest in cars and motorbikes and dune buggies and a number of other things. He really was, unfortunately, held in chains by his upbringing. But in this one, the film I kind of like for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, is the car chase. Everyone loves the car chase. But one of the other things I like about this film particularly is the fact the way it's filmed. Now, the director, Peter Yates, is in himself an interesting director. I saw him in his first film just the other week, which was a musical called Summer Holiday with Cliff Richard and Una Stubbs in it. And it was filmed really well. It's a very, very competent piece of filmmaking. It's got Cliff Richard in it, so it does have that downside, but one of the things Yates did very well was location filming. And the thing about Bullet is a lot of the film is on location. In fact, I don't even know how many times they used a studio rather than a location. It's got that enhanced reality because they film so much of it on location. And some of it even feels like a documentary. Scenes in the hospital when the two men are brought in after the attack on the safe house have that sense of reality rather than Hollywood reality. It's not a case of, in a Hollywood reality film, in a hospital, the doctor walks out of an operating theatre and he pulls down his surgical mask and talks to people and tells them what's wrong with the guys and all that kind of thing. It's a standard thing. You've seen it a million times in Hollywood films. This one, they show you people operating, and they may well have been genuine doctors operating or just very, very well trained actors, but it has that sense of reality about them. Everything around and in the city, even the climatic scene climactic scene, sorry, which takes place at San Francisco Airport, has that sense of reality about it. There are crowds coming through the airport. Bullet's got to find a killer. And there are incredible amounts of very ordinary-looking people, not the usual extras you get in a Hollywood film, in the background, just doing what they should be doing. And then you get that all the way through the film. The film has a grounding in a almost documentary reality, which makes it interesting for the films at the time. It was a bold choice to make, and probably a lot difficult to do than just do things the standard studio way, but Yates wanted to do it that way, and the studio went along with him for it. Warner Brothers went along with him for it. And it does then allow something as wild and over the top as this car chase, which is incredibly well filmed. Compare it to modern car chases. Just the sense of reality, the fact that they don't do a lot of quick cuts the way that modern ones do to get the feel of danger. The danger was actually there. The guys driving were only supposed to be going like 70k through the streets of San Francisco. They were getting up to around 70 miles an hour. They were getting up to around 110 at times and doing genuinely risky things. There's a sense of the weightiness of the cars moving, and these are the old-fashioned muscle cars as well. That sense of weightiness, you can't fake with CGI. CGI doesn't have the right physics for that kind of reality that reality itself has. And that's one of the lovely things about this film, that sense that people are risking their lives. There was no over-cranking on the cameras. When you see the cars dodging in and out of trucks and other traffic, and when you see all of that stuff, that's done at real speed. Bud Eakin and the other people on the stunt crew were incredibly adept professionals. They were the best of the best at the time. And that shows for it. McQueen did some of his own stunts. There's a scene where he drives off the road and does a 180. That's actually McQueen doing the 180 in the dirt on the side of the road there. But, of course, there were other scenes where they didn't permit him to do it. Nobody's going to let a large Hollywood star bounce cars over the hills of San Francisco. Not sure how this is working. Let me know what you think of this working in the background with the car chase scenes while I talk about Bullet. Now, of course, Jacqueline Bisset's in the movie as well, and to be honest with you, as Roger Ebert points out in his review of the movie at the time, she's just there for decoration. The female character is not integral to the plot of the film at all. She's just there to kind of humanize Frank Bullet, in a sense. And if she wasn't in the film, the film would be not much less than it is with her in it. And that's probably something that people learned in subsequent years. This is the 1960s. If you're going to put a woman in a modern action film, she's got to be in there for a reason. She's got to have a direct purpose rather than just being eye candy and a reward for a job well done at the end of the movie. So this is very much a guy's film. Robert Vaughn has said that this is one of his best acting roles, and I think so as well, playing the kind of slick, smooth, professional politician. Who's basically a real prick, is something that he does very well. And it's quite, of course, led on to him doing other roles where he's not playing Napoleon Solo, his character from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And McQueen and Vaughn were friends. Of course, they'd worked together on The Magnificent Seven, so Vaughn giving McQueen this opportunity is definitely something that Robert Vaughn in the interviews he's done for this appreciated. And it is, I mean, people, that's the end of the car chase by the look of things. Anyway, yep, so basically there's not too much else to say about Bullet, really, except that if you're going to look at a whole bunch of car movies, you couldn't go worse than spending the day with your Pringles and your beer watching Bullet and watching Vanishing Point and watching Two Lane Blacktop together. But remember when you do that, Bullet isn't just the car chase. It's also tightly plotted. It's got that enhanced sense of reality because of the location shooting. And there's some good acting there. As Zom pointed out, Robert Duvall's in the film as well, and a number of other interesting people. So that's about all I'm going to say about Bullet. If you haven't seen it, why the fuck not? If you don't have a copy of it, if I can get it for $9 here at the other end of the planet, you guys should be able to pick it up pretty cheaply on a good copy where you are. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and then we're going to talk about the second film, Mario Bava's stylish classic, Danger Diabolik. That, of course, was the theme to Danger Diabolik, written by Ennio Morricone, as indeed was all the music for the film. I'll just do a little bit of a blurb about the movie, and then we'll talk about important things like the director, the producer, and the stars of the film. So, Danger Diabolik is an Italian film from 1968, directed by Mario Bava, who we all know and love. It's based on a fumetti, an Italian comic book from the 1960s. And it stars John Philip Law as Diabolik, the thief. He lives in a ritzy hideout with his girlfriend Eva, played by Marissa Mell, while Inspector Ginko, played by Michele Piccoli, an actor I've got a great fondness for, tries to track him down. So basically, it's just a caper kind of thing, lots of style. Not a lot of substance, but very cool. It runs about 100 minutes. It also stars Terry Thomas. In the 1960s, Terry Thomas had a bit of a career as what the guys over at the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema call a check casher. He appeared in a whole bunch of films all around Europe. He was in the film we mentioned a few podcasts ago, Kiss the Girls and Make Them Die. He was in that. He was there as comedy relief, playing the comedy relief British guy. And in this case, he plays a minister for the Italian government for some reason. But all of this isn't important. I mean, the basis of Danger Diabolik, the thing that makes it so cool, is the pacing. And, of course, the fact that it is incredibly stylish. That's where we lead into talking about Mario Bava. Tim Lucas has written an incredibly long book about Mario Bava, which I'd love to get a copy of, but unfortunately it's outside the podcast budget. And it's an incredibly detailed, from all report, biography of Bava. And I'll just go into his background a little bit for those of you who aren't particularly familiar with it. Bava was born in 1914 and died in 1980. He was Italian, of course. He's a screenwriter, cinematographer, director, and some people say he's the godfather of Italian cult cinema. One of the things that makes him so good at what he did is the fact that before he ever directed a film, Mario Bava was the cinematographer on over 30 movies. Between the years 1943 and 1956, where he made his first film as a director, I Vampiri. And he went on to be a cinematographer in a number of films subsequent to that as well. But basically, that kind of cinematographer's eye is what stays with him. And it shows incredibly well in Danger Diabolik. This film is visually lush. It's incredibly rich in that way. He uses every trick in the book to kind of enhance visually and stylishly. And, of course, in moving the story along, he uses every trick in the book to enhance those things. He's got overcranked film for the car chases. He's got models hung in the foreground to cover up the fact that he doesn't have a set behind them. He uses matte paintings. He uses those false perspectives. He uses every trick possible to give this film an incredibly lush look. And even the set design is fantastic. One of the things you might remember from the film is after Diabolik steals a large amount of money, the scene with him and Eva on their big circular bed. That bed's a beautiful thing. It's in a slight spiral, and it's about, it must be, oh, I don't know, 15 meters across. And it's a big spiral around a central object, which has got the TV set in it. And it's a beautiful bed. It rotates. It's on a slight up ramp. It's a lounge. It's a bed. It's a beautiful piece of furniture, and it's something you don't see elsewhere. It's the film is got that beautiful pop art richness of the 1960s design. There's places where Eva and Diabolik shower in their cave hideout. The walkways around the cave. The fact that both of them drive E-type Jaguars. Hers is white. His is black. Which is, of course, based on the Fumetti, but visually this film is fantastically rich. Bava had a great eye for textures and camera angles. If you have a look even just towards the start of the film, where there are cars moving around, the textures of the brick walls where the cars are driving and the cobbled stones that the cars are driving across when you first see Diabolik's E-type Jag. He's picked somewhere where the cobblestones are done in arches, so there's a texture to even the surface the cars are running across. And one of the sad things about this film, of course, is that they actually run an E-type Jag off a cliff, which is always a nasty thing. And also a Citroen. And I kind of got a fondness for Citroens. I used to know somebody that was very big on Citroens, and so I've got a great fondness for them. So the thing with this film is, don't try to analyse it. Don't try to, you know, make it more than it is. What it is a fucking good entertainment. Marissa Mell is fantastically beautiful as Eva, Diabolik's girlfriend. John Philip Law looks fantastic and almost spider-like in his black jumpsuit with a black mask with only his eyes showing as Diabolik. And the kind of widow's peak hairstyle he wears is very cool as well. And he had, of course, those piercing blue eyes. And there are other actors in the film as well. I mentioned Michele Piccoli. The two films that I really liked and remember, there's three actually, sorry, one I haven't seen in a very long time. But the films I remember Michele Piccoli for are The Young Girls of Rochefort. I've talked about that in an early podcast. A movie called Le Grand Bouffe, which has got him, Marcello Mastroianni in it, Philippe Noiré, and Jean-Pierre Cassel. Really interesting compliment. I really should do it on the podcast at some stage. And also a movie I haven't seen since I was very young called Them Rock, where he plays a man who basically turns into a caveman in his apartment building. I want to see that again. If I can never find a copy of Them Rock, I really want to see that again. But Michele Piccoli, good serious actor, but he could play this kind of like comedy stuff very well as well. He was very versatile in it. Of course, Adolfo Celli's in the film playing one of the main gangsters who gets to do a few James Bond film villain moments, including he has a personal jet with a trapdoor in the floor of it, amongst other things. But Adolfo Celli, of course, you'll remember, played Emilio Largo in Thunderball a couple of years before this film was made. So he had his career well established playing nasty mafiosi or villains in that sense. I think, if I'm not mistaken, in the English language version of Danger Doughboy, his voice is dubbed by Paul Frees, a guy who was known as an actor, who's also known as a voiceover artist. He supplied the voice for, amongst other things, Boris Badenoff in Rocky and Bullwinkle. And one of the things that came out about Paul Frees in later years was he dobbed a lot of people into the FBI, where he suspected that they were communist subversives, and a lot of people were blacklisted because of, and also investigated and had surveillance put on them because of Paul Frees. So ultimately, he wasn't a very nice person at all, but his voice is very distinctive, and I believe that he is in this film doing the voiceover work for the English language version for the film. For a long time, this film was very difficult to find. There are only really bad prints of it available and really bad VHS dubs of it. So it's nice to see the film back again and in its full glory. It is just visually and stylistically lush. And it's also influential. If you saw a movie made by Roman Coppola a few years ago called CQ, it's very much stylistically based on Danger Diabolik. And in fact, John Philip Law has an acting role in the film. Of course, there's the Beastie Boys 1998 thing, Body Movin', had a parody of Danger Diabolik in it as well. So there are countries in the world that go through phases where they do some really cool exploitation movies. I mean, Hong Kong's done it, France has done it. They're actually doing it now, as I mentioned about that Emily Blanc-Seck movie that I saw recently. They're doing some beautiful steampunky films these days with historic backgrounds to them. And of course, exploitation, the 1970s and the 1980s in Australia were a time when Australia was doing good exploitation films, and the 60s were Italy's time then. The decade started with La Dolce Vita 50 years ago now, and really Italy became a cool place, and there's a kind of cultural blending between the coolness of Italy and the coolness of spy movies and kind of action caper films that comes into play in here. But this is where the whole Eurospy genre came from. The Cold War blending with the James Bond phenomenon, blending with the fact that in the 20 years after the war ended, 20 years after World War II ended, the countries in Europe that were badly affected by it were really starting to have their own cinema again and really doing interesting stuff. And this is definitely part of that wave of not large budget and award-winning European films, but the ones that people went to see in cinemas, the good, entertaining, fun flicks, and Danger Diabolik is definitely part of that genre of cool film. Just every time I watch it, I notice new things about the visual design. The fact that the entrance to their underground hideout is a model in front of a downward sloping road, so that it looks like the E-type Jag is actually going into the mouth of a clamshell doorway in a hill, where it's actually really a model. You can notice it if you look for it, but the fact that they did try to at least make that work is lovely. And the perspectives that Barva uses, for instance, when Diabolik is about to put the money in the safe after their first caper, the technology and the gadgety things that Barva frames John Philip Law in as he's opening the safe, and the style of the safe itself, shows Barva overcoming those budgetary limitations. Of course, probably the most noticeable film of Barva's, where he makes much more of a limited budget to enhance the story, is Planet of the Vampires, which he did in 1965, and which the film Alien stole a lot from. I really should do that Barva movie. I have been asked to do Barva movies, and probably Planet of the Vampires would be the other one that I'd really be interested in looking at for the podcast. The richness of Mario Bava's work, even when he was doing black and white films like Black Sunday, even without the benefit of rich colours, Bava had the ability to really frame things interestingly, use lighting in an interesting way, use sometimes almost abstract sets. I was thinking about part of the graveyard sets in Black Sunday, for instance, using those kind of almost sketched-in sets to really build a mood and enhance what he was doing way beyond what seemed possible for the budget of a particular film. This film only had a budget of about $500,000, I think, if Wikipedia is to be believed. But it has a richness that really goes beyond budget, and I'd love to see more filmmakers now using that kind of imagination. Of course, Barva had the advantage of having made films for 20-odd years solid before Danger Diabolik came out to hone his craft. But there are films now that I see where they use tiny touches of CGI or some other effect work to great effect, and for some reason that sometimes reminds me of Mario Bava with his hanging mats and his forced perspectives. People using the limitations as an advantage and as a trigger for finding imaginative ways of doing things. Really, any Mario Bava film is worth seeing, even one or two at the end which weren't particularly his best work. Visually, Bava's films are always unique, and I can't recommend them highly enough. And Danger Diabolik is a good entry point for the films of Mario Bava. Its style, it's got the beautiful Morricone score, it's lush, it's got beautiful people in it, it's got some comedy and some camp to keep things going. And probably the interesting thing is he did this immediately after one of his worst films, which is Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, which was a sequel to Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine starring Vincent Price. But even then, some Barva still comes through that the silliness of that film. If you can score the soundtrack to this film, it's one of the best movie soundtracks of the 1960s. I'll put it right up there with things like The Ipcrest File and Billion Dollar Brain for really cool exploitation film soundtracks. Morricone was the man as far as film soundtracks are concerned, and he doesn't let us down in this one. There's not too much else to say about Danger Diabolik. If you haven't seen it, see it. You're going to be in for a good time. If you have seen it and haven't seen it for a while, go back and visit it and just get the highest definition copy of it on the best TV you can watch it on. And I think you'll be well rewarded in doing so. Now I'm going to take another break now and come back with the feedback.
You wanna be Americano, Americano, Americano. You were born in Italy. You're living Alamo.
Sienta Megido Faffa, tu vuoi vivere alla moda, ma se bevi whisky e soda, vuoi sente disturba, tu ava loro che andrò, tu gioco a pese boh, ma è sorte pecca a me, chi te li dà la borsetta di mamma, tu vuoi far l'americano, americano, americano. Ma si nati in Italia, senza me non c'è sta niente a fa. Ok, napulita, tu vuoi fare l'America, tu vuoi fare l'America. Qui si sale la perro, qui si sale la perro, qui si sale la perro, qui si sale la perro.
That's Tu Vuoi Fa Americano, which you might remember was in The Talented Mr. Ripley with Jude Law and Matt Damon singing it, but that's the original version from the 1960s. Okay, on to the feedback. The first bit is from long-time listener, our old friend Rickster, a.k.a. Serps. He says, "Hi, Terry, just wanted to send a note letting you know I'm still alive." Well, make that undead. Life has a way of getting on top of you, doesn't it? But I wanted to let you know, I've still been listening and loving the podcast. However, it seems like every time I'm about to email you with a comment, you put out another new podcast episode and I keep falling behind with my comments. Belated congrats on your job situation as well as the radio gig. Couldn't happen to a nicer loony. Also, I wanted to tell Sal she's got a fellow Supernatural fan in me. So don't let Terry browbeat you. As I said, the podcast has been great as usual. I particularly enjoyed the Rod Taylor episode. I've always liked his work very much, but have sadly seen very little of it. Thanks for your recommendations. I now have a nice handful of Rod Taylor movies to check out. As for suggestions for future podcasts, how about the Sargasso manuscript? Okay, that's mean. But then there's always Santo and Blue Demon versus the Monsters. You could also go way back to the early years covered by Paleo Cinema and do something on a silent film like Waxworks, Order the Cat and the Canary, etc. All my best, Rickster, a.k.a. Serps. Thanks, Rickster. Always like hearing from you, mate. You were one of the first people that I got comments from, and I always do appreciate that. I think it's a Sargasso manuscript or something like that. I actually downloaded it, but I haven't watched it yet. If it turns out to be a total turd, I'm going to blame you. But thank you for the feedback. Yeah, Santo movies, Mexican wrestler movies. Someone steer me in the direction of a few of those, will you? Send me a link on where I can find them, because I want to kind of get into them a little bit. I'm always willing to expand my exploitation genres. There is actually an exploitation genre documentary coming up by the same people that did Not Quite Hollywood. It's called Machete Maidens Unleashed, and it's about Filipino exploitation cinema. Maybe by the same guys who did the one here in Australia. Definitely want to see that when it comes out. I'm sure it'll get a DVD release in this country at least, but if it's showing where you are, do definitely check it out. The trailer is up on the Paleo Cinema website, And it looks like it's going to be a shitload of fun for exploitation movie fans. So thanks for that, Rickster. Someone send me some links to Mexican wrestler movies. That's all I've got to say on that. And also, sorry, doing silent films. Yeah, I want to actually have a look at and talk about the restored Metropolis when I can get a hold of a copy of it too. And speaking of old things, I've now got a voicemail from another one of our friends, Vince Rotolo, over at the B-Movie Podcast. If you're not listening to the B-Movie Cast, give it a go. Him and Nick, his co-host, and also Juan and whoever else he gets in to talk about films. They always talk about cool exploitation films. And Vince has sent me a voicemail, so here it is.
Hey, Terry, it's Vince from the B-Movie Cast. Hope you're doing good. Just wanted to say I've been really enjoying the shows and I really like the cool music in between the segments and everything. First of all, I just wanted to say real quick, thanks for turning me on to Sam Fuller. When I heard you cast, when you talked about Shock Corridor, really piqued my interest now to check it out. And I really enjoyed the film. What a crazy movie that was. So I got interested in him. And then we did the show on Targets with Boris Karloff. Peter Bogdanovich directed that. And he said he had wrote the script, him and another woman, and they really didn't like it. So Sam Fuller was his friend, came over, and he said he rewrote the whole script for him in one night. And so between that and Shock Corridor, I was really interested in him. So I've been checking out some of his other movies. Got to watch The Naked Kiss. That's another strange movie. Really some crazy stuff in it. And I didn't know if you noticed on the one scene when she gets off the bus, she's coming to town, gets off the bus, and you can see it, the movie marquee right there. It's a playing Shock Corridor. I thought that was really cool too, but never knew I really liked film noir until I started watching Sam and listening to your podcast. So I also picked up the movie Detour and watched it. It's another one. It's really crazy. It's just, you know, it's one of the movies you watch, and it's just amazing what, you know, what 24 hours can make a huge change in your life. But anyway, those movies are really great. So keep the shows coming. And also thanks for the Rod Taylor retrospect. I almost forgot about Rod, but I started thinking about him once you did your podcast. And I really didn't know he was Australian either, to tell you the truth. And I remember him, you know, from The Time Machine, which is, you know, one of his real famous movies. And the one that stuck with me, though, I think when I saw in the theaters, I think I was about 17 back in 68, went to a theater and the one screen theater. I don't know if you remember those, but we saw Dark of the Sun. And I always never, you know, that scene really stuck with me where the train gets disconnected and, you know, kind of floats back down the track. I won't say too much more on that to spoil it for anybody that wants to see it, but it's one of those, you know, you see certain movies and certain things stick in your brain, even when you're young like that. But I do remember that. And last but not least, I wanted to congratulate you on your radio gig. That must be really, really cool to check that, to have something like that. Really, really neat. So congrats on that. And then I guess last but not least, well, I won't say last but not least, but you could send us some of what Zom's smoking. And we were trying to get somebody to mail in a voicemail to our show, you know, with a cool Australian accent. If you know anybody that, you know, has one of those, that maybe you can get them to call it our show. Anyway, I'm going to let you go now, Terry. Thanks a lot, dude.
I always thought I had a cool Australian accent, but thanks for that, Vince. I'm really glad I could hip you to film noir. That's you're doing what I'm doing, which is sharing the love and steering people in the direction of stuff they might like. So the fact that I can give back to you that way, mate, is means a lot to me. So, Rod Taylor, Dark of the Sun, it's becoming one of my favourites, apart from Sunday in New York, which I like for the comedy aspects, and the VIPs, which I like for the rapport between him and Maggie Smith. Rod is an Australian, definitely. He's born in Sydney like I was. And we claim a lot of New Zealanders as Australians when it comes to actors. I mean, people like Russell Crowe, though. The gloss has gone off his trophy a little bit in later years. But, thanks for that, Vince. Really appreciate it, mate. Listen to Vince's podcast, people, the B-Movie Cast. You can find it on iTunes and other places. It's well worthwhile, and he's got an incredible long list. He's done 150, 160 episodes. I could be wrong, but somewhere around there, of basically B-movie stuff. And I definitely recommend that you hip yourself to that if you haven't already. Got another voicemail now.
Hey, this is Richard in Wichita. Let me first congratulate you on your new radio gig. It's obviously got you very pumped. That's very cool. You know, I definitely can relate to your excitedness about having, you know, people interested in hearing what you have to say. And I kind of liken it to a few years ago when I left my first voicemail on the Cinema Slave podcast that was hosted by Joe Barlow. And, you know, first off, I was blown away the first time I heard my voicemail had been, you know, played, let alone the fact that Joe was interested in a lot of what I had to say. Kind of opened the floodgates, and, you know, where I am now, where I'm leaving voicemails on four podcasts, yours and B-MovieCast, Dread Media, and Mail Order Zombie, all of those on a regular or semi-regular basis, and that's always exciting. So congrats on that radio gig. Love the show on Rod Taylor. I thought it was very cool, and I like the idea of going with one actor and just kind of highlighting, you know, three movies, whether they be mainstream movies, your personal favorites, out of the mainstream, whatever the case may be. I think that's an interesting, you know, way of doing the show, and I think you should, you know, continue to go ahead and do that. You know, maybe targeting different genres as much as possible when you choose an actor, because, you know, some actors have a pretty wide range. I'm thinking George C. Scott, for example. I think three of his most famous movies come from three very distinct genres. You've got Patton, you have The Changeling, and A Christmas Carol. I think his 1984 Christmas Carol is often underrated. I think it tends to get overshadowed by some of the other versions, but I just rewatched that version last year for the first time, honestly, since it played on television for the very first time, which I think was 1984. So, you know, what are we talking, 25 years between viewings? I love A Christmas Carol. I watch numerous versions every year. The 1951 version with Alistair Sim is my personal favorite. I also like Patrick Stewart's version for different reasons. You know, I'm a fan of Patrick Stewart's, and there's just a lot of visuals in that film that I think are great. I don't necessarily think he was the best Scrooge, but you know, visually speaking, I think the movie was great. But George C. Scott's version was really good. It surprised me how much I enjoyed it, and I plan on viewing it again this year. I actually have it on Netflix streaming, so I'll be watching that here on Netflix. You know, I just recently revisited The Changeling for the first time, I think, in many, many, many years. I'm not even sure that I really saw it all the way through. But I really, really love that. It's one of the best ghost stories that I've ever seen. That's definitely got some creepy scenes in it. And, of course, Patton. I mean, what needs to be said about Patton? But you know what? I haven't heard a podcast on Patton, so maybe you're the man to do it. You know, another idea would be maybe to pick actors who have played James Bond and highlight films that, you know, other films other than James Bond. I think that would be pretty easily done with, you know, Sean Connery or Roger Moore. Might be a bit more difficult with, like, George Lazenby, although I know he was in The Man from Hong Kong, which I don't think you've covered on your show, but that would be kind of interesting. Maybe you did. Maybe you have in one of the older episodes. But in any case, that'd be interesting maybe to revisit that or find another movie from Lazenby. Of course, you've got Timothy Dalton, you've got Pierce Brosnan, you've got Daniel Craig. So I think you could come up with three movies between the three of them. It'd be interesting. Sean Connery's movie Zardoz, another film I haven't watched in probably 20 years, is actually on my DVR at the moment waiting to be viewed. As we are now in November and I have overdosed on horror movies last month, the last 2 months of the year, I always kind of shift gears. I'm a big sci-fi horror fan, and that's probably the primary, you know, selection of films that I watch 10 months out of the year. But I always kind of feel the need to cleanse my palate in November, and I oftentimes, you know, kind of shift gears and watch a lot of comedies. But this year, I find myself in a Clint Eastwood mode. In the past year, I've made a lot of purchases of Clint Eastwood's Westerns, movies that I've seen numerous times but never actually had in my collection. I was able to get a lot of them really cheap, and because DVDs are pretty cheap now. The Blu-rays have kind of replaced them here in the States for the most part. I think you can get a lot of DVD titles for $4 or $5 if you're, you know, smart shop and catch it at the right time. So I've been rewatching a lot of these great Clint Eastwood westerns, and I also have the Dirty Harry Blu-ray set that I'm working my way through, which is excellent. A lot of great extras on that. So with that, that could be another actor you could choose, and I'll kind of segue into a question here. Just kind of curious, since I've been in this Clint Eastwood mode, what are your favorite Clint Eastwood films? Why don't you know maybe what's your favorite Clint Eastwood western? What's your favorite Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry film? And maybe your favorite Clint Eastwood action film that was not Dirty Harry. Be interested to hear your take on that. You know, his new movie Hereafter with Matt Damon. I'm not a huge Matt Damon fan, but I don't necessarily, you know, hate watching Matt Damon movies. I'm kind of interested in that. You know, Clint Eastwood is usually pretty spot on as a director, so that's kind of got me interested. I don't think we'll be seeing him act again. I think Gran Torino is going to be a great way for him to end his career. I think he'd be hard-pressed to find another role that would surpass his role in that film, but I could be wrong. Maybe there's that one last role. I know so many people would like to see him play Dirty Harry again, and in my mind, Gran Torino was almost like him playing Dirty Harry now at an advanced age. I think that's as close as he's going to get to playing that character again. I'm not sure I'd want to see him revisit the role of Dirty Harry. I think the 5 movies he did were great. It's been a long time since he played Dirty Harry, and obviously he's got a lot of limitations. So, you know, as he said in one of his movies, you know, a man's got to know his limitations, and I think Clint Eastwood has realized that Dirty Harry train has long since passed on. With that, sir, I leave you with just words that you're doing a great show as always. Again, really enjoyed the Rod Taylor show. Got me thinking about the other possible actors that you could go down that route. Really enjoyed that. And again, congrats on the radio gig. And as always, take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Richard. Roles by James Bond actors. A Fine Madness with Sean Connery, where he plays a New York poet, is a pretty interesting one. It's got Gene Seberg in it as well, and Gene Seberg was always watchable in a film. Now, sashaying and segueing between that statement and Clint Eastwood, my favourite Clint Eastwood film, Paint Your Wagon. I think it's a tragic musical, and I love the fact that Clint Eastwood sings 2 songs at least, and the fact that he could not hold a tune in an iPod makes it even better. I kind of like it when they fail, in a sense. And of course, it's got Lee Marvin in it as well, and Harve Presnell singing "They Call the Wind Mariah," which is one of the great moments of musical cinema. But, I like Clint in that role because he's playing against type. He's holding it in and doesn't look too happy about it at times, but that's my favourite Clint role. Thank you very much for the feedback. There's so much in there. George C. Scott, not one of my favourite actors. I kind of remember him from The Hustler, which is one of the secondary roles he did, which I kind of like a lot. I also like him in Day of the Dolphin, where he plays a guy who trains dolphins. I can't really find a decent copy of that film, unfortunately. I'd love to, because I think it's a silly film, but the dolphins were quite cute. And I never warmed to George C. Scott. I think he's okay in Dr. Strange. Love doing the over-top thing, but I can understand his qualities as an actor, but you've got to have that essential connection to an actor to really like them. And I understand, Richard, that you have that with George C. Scott, but I don't particularly. But as far as doing podcasts themed around a single actor, yeah, I want to do it again. I actually want to do some female actors as well. I want to do Ida Lupino, for instance. I've really got to kind of work on that a little more. I've already talked about one of her films, I think, Roadhouse. But I do want to do a bit about Ida Lupino. I already did Warren Oates, of course. I think the first one of those I did. But there are other actors that I really want to go with. I wouldn't mind doing Bogart, some of the lesser known Bogart films, which have got some interesting aspects to them as well. I could kind of fold in things like In a Lonely Place and Left Hand of God and things like that that Bogart did in his later career that were very interesting films and interesting from a technical viewpoint to watch him as an actor, to see the things he does to convey the character of the person he's playing. So, yeah, I mean, this is opening up. This is one of the good times in my life. I've got my work's life settled down. I've got the podcast going well. I've got this radio thing happening as well. Sal and I are enjoying a great time in our life in a lot of ways. Her health issues are starting to improve. And one of the things I'd like to say is that everybody who listens to the podcast and offers feedback or even just listens to it is a part of that quality time in my life. And I'd like to thank you guys for being a part of that. It really is appreciated. So there's not much else I'm going to do now. I am going to be back in 2 weeks with something else entirely new. So that's about it this time around. It is getting late at night and I do need to get my beauty rest. One cannot live on espressos alone. I used to do cappuccinos, now I do espressos. But thanks to everybody that offered the feedback. Oh yeah, I've got one more piece of feedback. Jeez, I nearly forgot. Let me just go back into my emails and I'll find that, because I did get a comment from Zom, which came through good old Facebook to most people. Just let me bring that up on the screen. Podcast comments. I've got a saved file of podcast comments here. Just be a moment, I'll read out Zom's one. Okay, here we go. Zom says, just a thought, maybe a podcast about films about obsession. This has come up before. But thinking outside the box, not just a man obsessed with a woman or vice versa, maybe like The Searchers or Red River, Point Blank with Lee Marvin, Zodiac, Star 80. I'm sure there are lots of other movies from way back that could be considered. Just the thought while I was walking around Walmart grocery shopping. Cheers, love the Rod Taylor episode. Best wishes to you and your lady and Jack the Cat, Zom. Yeah, films about obsession. One film I wanted to do, I haven't really had a chance to yet, is Compulsion, with Orson Welles and Dean Stockwell and Bradford Dillman. And I think Gene Kelly's in that as well. I wanted to do that one from 1959 as well, and that's very much a film about obsessions and things like that. But The Searchers has been done over so many times, so many ways, by so many people. I'm really going to pass on that one because there is such a rich body of comment out there about The Searchers. I recommend people see it. Point Blank, probably, yeah, I've got a very good DVD copy of Point Blank that would be worth doing, and I can kind of look into what Borman does with that film to make it as interesting as it is. But thanks for that, Zom. I've got so many things to do now. And I'm going to love every minute of doing them. I may not get to everything that everybody suggests, but even if I don't get to your specific suggestions, you're going to be steering me in a direction that I like to go. And, of course, I'm still at the tiller, but I don't mind people offering input and doing that. And I will, again, as I said, do themed episodes. I find them actually easier to do than going, what films am I going to do? And then finding some films that I can do together. So they're, in that sense, they're easier. They take a little more research, and that's not a bad thing in itself, but they're easier to put together than a scattershot of a couple of different films. With this fortnightly schedule, I'm going to be doing two movies an episode rather than three. So just be aware of that as well. At the top of the podcast, you've got all the contact details. I'm going to go off now and knit the raveled sleeve of care, get a bit of sleep, and I'll upload this in the morning. So take care of yourselves, enjoy your movie viewing, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye.